Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we've got some bees.
All over the place.
A bit of a buzz. Bees, mowers, and some roses. So how about that?
The big three.
The big three. But yeah, we were interested in getting a little bit of a bee update from state apiarist Phil Kraft. I'd been hearing some news headlines, Bob, that stress was part of the factor that
It was a funny disease, colony collapse disorder. Sounds pretty serious. Yeah.
Well, people would go into their hives and like the bees would be gone, sort of thing. So they're trying to figure out. And I mean, what last time we talked about it, wasn't somebody saying that it was like cell phone?
That's right.
Cell phone interference, and you're like, no.
They're staying there at night, maybe, or something like that.
So there's been a little bit more sort of trying to figure out what's going on, and Phil's going to bring us up to speed on that. And then, if you love roses,
I do.
And the All America selection. So this is a different organization, although they've got this similar name. But the All America selections for roses, not the same as it is for annuals and bedding plants and stuff like that. But they've been around for a very long time, and they are constantly watching for super great roses. And Tom Carruth is joining us today to talk about the selections coming down the pike here that if you're a rose lover, you'll want to add to your garden.
As a guy with a 90-foot arbor, I'm learning because I mistakenly thought that climbing roses bloomed more often than they do. Most of them just kind of bloom once it
seems. They pop and then that's it. Yeah.
They go away, so I'm filling in with other stuff. So I got a lot to learn myself about roses.
Good.
So I'll listen to the show, I promise.
Okay, good. And then another visit with Peter Sawchuk and Consumer Reports.
Lawnmower man. Yeah, he's got a job. He tests power drills and lawnmowers and heavy equipment like that. The best part about them, of course, is that they're middle of the road. They're not paid by industry. They don't tell lies. They just test things and give you honest evaluations of their opinions. Very interesting show on what push mowers he thinks are best and why. Some surprising results, maybe. So stick around, folks, as you'll learn what you're doing wrong with your lawnmower and what you can't do about it.
I certainly will be listening to that as well. Bob and I, since we have more property, I'm very conscious of the way that I use my mowing equipment.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in terms of pollution, in terms of gas consumption, I know my mother has, she purchased an electric mower for her little backyard in town, and she likes that. Yeah. So it's like based on your needs, there are different things to consider. And with the change in, the way that people want to treat the environment a little more soundly, maybe reduce their fuel use, we have turned to Peter and Consumer Reports to sort of give us an assessment.
When I was a kid, back in the 1950s, we had a push electric mower with a cord on it because my dad worked for a cord company. It must have been 900 foot of cord out there.
Oh, wow.
It was awful.
I bet it was
10 times slower than the real mower.
Yeah. I would think, I'm so used to vacuuming the house that I would be able to use a push mower. Maybe women can do it better than men because we're the ones that vacuum predominantly.
I had an acre yard.
Yeah.
So it was tough.
Well, yeah, exactly.
I'd be out there for
weeks. Depends on how much you got.
Weeks and weeks.
But you had a 900 foot cord, so what are you complaining about?
That's true.
All right. What's going on in your garden these days, Bob?
I'm upgrading our containers. I've kind of gotten into container garden this year, particularly in Janet's garden. And I noticed they had the midsummer droops. Some of the perennials I'd planted early had faded away. And so now I'm consciously sticking in annuals and cutting back annuals and trying to keep the containers looking fresh and vibrant all year, which is kind of a new thing for me, but I think it's necessary.
Yeah. Don't you hire people to do that normally?
Yeah. Her name's Janet, but she's had an off summer, so so it hasn't been that easy. But And the other thing is the Bob Bog is coming along really well. I got a lot of my former lake turned bog, so... But boy, the dragonflies are out, and a lot of the native beasts are out there, and the flowers are coming up, and the water lilies are really looking good. We're going to do a show here pretty soon on water lilies and the best kinds for containers or bogs. But I'm excited. I get down there now and sit on my bench, and all my water lilies are popping, and it's just really, it's coming together.
It doesn't take that long for things to come together,
gosh.
Does it?
The day, 2 years ago, there were 1 gallon containers.
Yeah.
And now they're the lilies of 8 Utica. I mean, they're just really cranking.
That's great.
It's pretty. How about your place?
So tell me what you think about this.
Okay.
We've been harvesting some apples from the orchard. You know, and last year we got nothing because of the late freeze.
Right.
And they are delicious. And, not all of them, but the majority of the stuff back there. And, of course, we do get disease-resistant varieties. But I'm not necessarily talking about disease when I talk about pests. This time around.
All right.
They're clean as a whistle, Bob. They're like beautiful. And you know, we don't spray. So, okay, the cherries earlier when we were picking cherries. Mom usually is in charge of picking cherries and pitting because I just can't.
Moms are for, yeah.
Well, I'm so, I got other stuff that to do that's, you know, more pressing.
If it's smaller than a muskmelon, I don't do it.
Yeah. So she sits and she likes to do it. She sits and she pits cherries and, you know, looks for worms, right?
Yep.
Usually they're wormy. So this year they were really clean.
Uh-oh.
So I got to thinking.
Makes you nervous.
Last year, no. Think about what happened last year. We didn't have any cherries. We didn't have any fruit back in the orchard.
Oh, I know where this is going.
Did a season of nothing starve out, you know, not starve out completely, but reduce the incidence of pests, insect pests.
Yeah.
I mean, even disease pests too, really. But pest problems this year because there was nothing for anybody to live off of last year.
Bad news being they're going to double
They may.
Next year.
Exactly. But do you know what I mean?
I think you're onto something there. Seriously.
I mean, it makes sense.
It does. I hadn't thought about that.
So, you know, at least we're getting for suffering so last year, you know, with nothing. We're getting something back in return this year.
And if you're going to move to town, kid, this is a year because next year they could come back and haunt you.
It'll probably take a couple of years for it to build back up. At least I've got a couple more years. What do you think?
Yeah, there's been really cold winters, I think, when the following year the bugs weren't as bad. So that makes sense. The wishy theory of great cherries.
I guess.
I'm with
anyway. So I'm excited because the fruit's beautiful. All right. Speaking of fruit, one of the trickiest things to do, I think, is fruit. And, you know, like apple orchards and stuff.
Yeah.
But you can learn how to do it properly and become a master gardener. Jefferson County Extension is offering up their classes here pretty soon, aren't they?
Yeah, it's exciting. This is a great program. And people often say, I want to be a master gardener. I wish I had time to go. Well, this is
just
kind of for retired people.
Yeah.
Master Gardener is a great program on both sides of the river here. And there's going to be a new Jefferson County Cooperative Extension Master Gardener class. It's forming at the Southwest Government Center on Dixie Highway. Classes will be held Tuesdays and Thursdays at 9 a.m. and noon. Courses run September to November. For more information, call 569-2344 or go to our website and we'll post this. Again, if you want to be a master gardener, this is your chance, folks.
Yeah, classes are starting soon, so you want to get registered.
You betcha.
And out at UDell, August 16th from 1 o'clock to 3 p.m., there is a hummingbird workshop. You can learn about how to entice hummingbirds, how to feed them, all kinds of stuff. So people will be on hand to answer your questions.
I thought they were going to weed.
You thought they were going to what?
Teach them how to weed and stuff. It's a workshop?
All hummingbirds out there, if you're listening, there's a volunteer opportunity for you out at UDell.
Buzz on over.
There you go. And if you're interested, this is a fabulous conference if you're interested in the politics of food. The Healthy Food Local Farms Conference every year. This year it's coming up September 6th. It's 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. and it's going to be in Louisville at the University of Louisville. Featured speaker is Daniel Imhoff, who's the author of Food Fight. Some local speakers, Wendell Berry, Christopher Cook, Judy Wick, etc. But the registration has started, so check out our website at WFPL.org or our local Sierra Club. They sponsor it, so you can go to their website as well. But registration is recommended, and again, the date's September 6th. So.
And you cannot have local food without local bees.
You can't.
We know that.
And one of the things that the bees sort of sustain themselves on are roses. So we're going to hit roses first, and then we'll check in with Phil Kraft. But for now, the All-America Rose Selections board president is joining us, Mr. Tom Carruth. Tom, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dean.
Sure. Listen, we've often talked to Nona Koivula about regular All-America selections, never hit the Rose All-America selections. Can you give us a little background on the whole thing?
Sure. Actually, it was in the 20s that the U.S. government passed the plant patent law, which allowed people to patent their new inventions and collect royalties.
Ah.
So suddenly everybody was out to get rich by making and introducing new seedlings.
Huh.
And by the mid-30s, the rose nursery business especially saw a flood of new seedlings coming on the market with inadequate testing and no promotion.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in 1938 that the All-America Rose Selection Organization was formed with the idea of testing these seedlings and promoting the ones that performed well on a nationwide basis.
Mm-hmm.
So our very first introductions were in 1940.
Okay. What, do you know what some of the introductions were? Do you recall?
Oh, boy. Now you're going to test my historical knowledge here. I think one of the earliest ones was called The Chief. And Dixon's Red. Some of those most early ones are not easy to come by these days, but there are a couple of full collections of all the WARS winners in the United States.
Was there one called Rose Bowl?
There was not one called Rose Bowl yet.
Not yet. Somebody might just snag that name, Bob, for the next introduction. So the All-America selections were around already, so the Rose selection was something that just... So, I mean, are you all affiliated with each other?
We are not affiliated with each other, and in fact, we came first.
Okay, you came first. All right.
Yes.
But so no official affiliation by any means.
No.
Okay.
No, I think they just saw the potential for testing,
everything.
You know, bedding plants and vegetable varieties under a similar situation for what was set up in the roses.
Right. Okay, when you think about certain plants... And roses come to mind, certainly in this category, you know, hostas, daylilies, that sort of thing. There are so many named varieties and so many different varieties. So how on earth do you all go about selecting the, you know, I mean, even the large pool before you actually, you know, pick the winners? How do you decide among so many?
You know, in the hybridizers themselves, there are about three firms that are hybridizing in the United States, and it's up to them to reduce their initial entries down to a reasonable quantity.
Okay.
And we provide a fee incentive by increasing the fees.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
If they get too many.
Good point.
So we narrow it down to about between 40 and 50 entries per year.
Okay.
How bloody does that get? Is it pretty contentious at times?
Oh, yeah, it can be. And it's amazing, really, that a lot of times... The introducing firms will come up with a similar new color or new style just within a very close time to each other from different bloodlines, and it's always the first one to the hurdle, you know, that gets the golden ring.
So a lot of intrigue and CIA kind of stuff, too, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, I can make a good book.
Tom, what is the criteria in terms of making it into the short and then even shorter list of the All-America Rose selections?
Well, once it goes into the trials, then it passes into the hands of the judges. And we're in 24 different locations, each garden with its own judge and standby judge. And they have a criteria of 15 different qualities that they're looking for. So there's fragrance, disease resistance, shape of the flower, color of the flower, the abundance of the rebloom, the overall habit of the plant, how pleasant the flower is in the landscape, the impression of the plant, and then, of course, even personal opinion. We try to get rid of that, but it's not really possible.
Yeah. Right.
So a big factor, of course, right now is disease resistance, because we know that people are looking for roses that are easier to care for.
So we're putting more and more,
especially on the shrub varieties, which are expected to perform with very little care.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you have different categories within the competition, if you will, for shrub, for hybrid tea, for grandiflora, or is everybody lumped together?
Yes. No, we do divide them up by those classes.
Okay. So the winners this year?
The winners this year are three varieties for 2009. And it's a shrub, a floribunda, and a hybrid tea. And it's an interesting mix of groups this year because we've got the strictest standards we've ever put forward on the shrubs, producing a winner quite quickly. It was about 4 years ago that we decided to instruct the gardens to stop spraying the shrub or landscape types completely. And we figured it would be a while before a completely clean variety emerged from that change of regulation. And in fact, within the second year, Carefree Spirit came forward.
Is that one of the buck roses?
It is not. It is a variety from the Mayon family in France.
Okay.
And it is quite clean, a sort of a cerise red and white bicolor with a white eye. Small flowers, but in huge clusters. And it gives a lot of color in the landscape.
Wow.
And it's just impervious.
So when will that be available to consumers?
That will be available in the spring of 2009.
Okay. Carefree?
Carefree Spirit.
Carefree Spirit.
Yeah.
All right, so that's your shrub rose. Who's your Floribunda?
The Floribunda is one of my creations, and it's called Cinco de Mayo.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually a seedling of Julia Child, which has quickly gained fame as a good rose.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
talks funny, yeah.
This one is a hard-to-describe color. It's going to be very interesting to see how people greet it. It opens up as sort of a smoky orange and then finishes in the lavender tones.
Hmm.
Wow.
But you have these huge clusters of very ruffled flowers that bear all those different colors at once. And the nice part about it is it just blooms and blooms and blooms and blooms and blooms. You don't even have to deadhead it. It will come right back on top of itself with more flowers.
Wow.
And keeps a great habit with dark red new foliage.
And relatively disease.
Yes, it's quite clean. It's not as clean as the shrub.
Okay.
But it is one that I would classify as easy to grow.
Okay.
And excellent in the landscape as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a kinky hybridizing fact, Julia Child is actually the father on this variety.
Very kinky hybridizing fact.
We won't tell anybody.
All right. Okay. Who was the mother?
The mother was a variety called Topsy Turvy.
Okay.
Go figure.
Sounds good.
Which goes back to Betty Boop.
So that's Cinco de Mayo, and that's of your creation?
Yes, it is one of my hybrids.
All right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, and the hybrid tea.
The hybrid tea is called Pink Promise, and it's the first winner from Coiner Nurseries.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely classic hybrid tea with a long cream and pink blend bud and long stems. The tie to it, though, that's going to be interesting is that it is directly provides monies into the National Breast Cancer Foundation with each sale.
Oh, sure.
So that's hence the name Pink Promise,
Pink Promise.
Right, yeah,
on it. Yeah. So you'll be getting a lot of information not only from AARS but also from the National Breast Cancer Foundation to the beauty of this rose and the value of it.
Sure.
So I think it will appeal to a lot of people not only for that but just because of the beauty of the flower itself.
Absolutely. Sounds exciting. We'll have to look for those next spring, 2009.
I think it's a good group.
It sounds like it. Hey, listen, do you just hybridize for fun, or you work for somebody?
I wish I could.
Okay. And who do you work for?
I work for Weeks Roses.
Okay.
We're a wholesale company.
Okay. Tom, thank you so much. We appreciate your time and your expertise, and we'll look forward to those roses come springtime.
Nice to talk with you, Janine.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Tom Carruth is board president of the All America Rose Selections. For more information, of course, you can visit our website at wfpl.org.
Well, Miss Wishy, to be or not to be, that is the question.
No. To rose or not to a rose
by any other name would
still smell sweet.
Maybe we should just move along here.
Maybe we should leave it to the experts, right?
Right.
Yes, as we promised, we wanted an update on colony collapse disorder. So Phil Kraft is joining us. He is the Kentucky Department of Agriculture's state apiarist. Phil, welcome to Homegrown.
Happy to be here.
Great. Listen, give us a brief rundown of the colony collapse disorder. You know, when it became apparent, how it manifests itself.
Yeah, this is a problem that began in the winter of 2006-2007, so it's not this past winter, but you know, two winters ago is when it started. And what we began seeing, this was first reported actually in November of 2006, among some migratory beekeepers. I'm going to talk more about migratory beekeepers in a second, but among some a particular migratory beekeeper who has hives. He goes sort of back and forth with hives from Pennsylvania to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was he had left these hives, and really they were in really good condition several weeks before.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes back to them, and what he discovers is they had went from being what we call strong hives. The term strong is used to describe a hive. A beehive is having lots and lots of bees. They went from being a very strong hive to a very weak hive. But what was especially puzzling was that we had conditions that otherwise, he had conditions in his hives that otherwise made them look very healthy. There were lots of developing bees, and this was really unusual because typically if you have this sort of decline,
mm-hmm.
you have a decline in
overall,
the reproduction of the bees too. And so it was. It seemed as if, and this is what the press has been saying, part of the bees had just disappeared. Now we really don't think they disappeared, like went into the ozone or something. We think they flew away and died.
Okay.
There's lots of theories, and it's all theory, conjecture, when people say, well, they got lost, they got disoriented. Absolutely no evidence that they got disoriented. That's a theory. So that's sort of the condition that happened that winter. And then that was the beginning. This was November, beginning of winter. And other beekeepers then began seeing this similar thing occurring. A lot of them in Florida and different places around the country. Again, these big migratory beekeepers. And their hive, and they continued on up until last summer,
mm-hmm.
And then they sort of quit. And then this winter, they didn't start as early. They seem, from what I hear, they started later, perhaps in February.
Who started later? The migratory beekeepers,
the same sort of unexplained loss of bees, weakening of colonies, in the winter. So let me say that, and I use the term migratory beekeeper. I want to explain when we think of terms of the types of beekeepers we have. We have small beekeepers, in which we have a lot of them in Kentucky, which just have a small number of hives. I'm talking as few as one or two hives to maybe five or six hives, and those are typically considered, or up to 10 maybe, small beekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the next sort of group of beekeepers we have are what are often called sideline beekeepers or part-time beekeepers. They may have as few as 15 hives, maybe 100 or 200. These are people that aren't really full-time beekeepers, but they're making some money with their hives. And we have a lot of those in Kentucky. But there's another size of beekeeper, which we just don't have here, and it's a matter of scale. So you got big beekeepers, and then part of the big beekeepers, the big commercial beekeepers, are what we call migratory beekeepers. And they are the guys that move bees around the country on tractor trailers to do pollination. They have thousands of hives. If you're a migratory beekeeper and have 3,000 hives, you're small.
How far do they move and how often
do they move?
They move
them all over the country. They typically they start in February. They go to California to pollinate the almonds. And this is a fascinating story.
Mm-hmm.
We have, right now, over 1 million hives of bees are moved every year to the almonds to pollinate the almond groves, the almonds and the almond groves in California. 1 million hives of bees.
Wow.
Half the bees in the United States in February are in California in the almonds.
Wow.
Almonds have to have bees for pollination. So that's how they start. These guys start in February. From then on out until late fall, their bees are constantly on the road. They may leave the almonds and they may go to Georgia to pollinate things in Georgia. Then they may go to Maine to do cranberries.
Hmm.
They may go to, some of them leave the almonds and go to the Northeast to do apples and things. Some of them leave and go to the Midwest to pollinate.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are just constantly on the move for the next 6 months.
So, Phil, these bees, are they the ones that are experiencing the colony collapse
disorder?
They're
the ones that we know are experiencing this loss of bees, which is called colony collapse disorder.
So you suggested, some of them are getting disoriented, not coming back. But what are people thinking about the reasons for colony collapse disorder now, after having a couple of years to sort of assess the situation?
Well, to be honest, after 2 years, they still don't know. They have some theories.
So theory.
And one difficult thing with this is what they call a symptom described problem. There's not a test you can do to say they've got this.
Right.
Disease and pathogen is one thing they think, and I want to emphasize think, could be involved. So far, no evidence. They're looking at viruses. They've been doing tests on viruses and have shown that there's several new viruses they didn't know about. However, they had never tested before.
Mm-hmm.
The other things they do is, because it does seem to be a problem that's more the migratory beekeepers, you see we have other large beekeepers in the country. There's beekeepers in Georgia and Florida who never move. Those beekeepers really don't seem to be affected.
Okay.
So they're looking at the things that makes migratory beekeeping different. Well, one of that is just that movement. You've got to believe that loading 500 hives and putting them on a tractor trailer and moving them 500 miles is not a normal sort of thing, and it's a stressful thing on the bees.
Yeah, well, Phil, I still have no sense of the real problem. What percent of the bees are we losing, and how does it affect the crops specifically?
To be honest, I don't have accurate numbers in my fingertips, but I've been hearing that a lot of the migratory beekeepers lost half their hives last year and half or more again this year. Wow. Now, you've got to remember, they have always lost hives. Unfortunately, all beekeepers lose hives. Here in Kentucky, if we lose 20% of our hives, that's not
normal.
Bad.
Okay.
And then what we do is in the spring, we replace our losses by doing what we call dividing our hives. We put some of our bees into a hive and we introduce a new queen and we start a new hive. So the migratory beekeepers have always lost hives and they've always have made up their losses. But it's a lot tougher to make up half when you've lost half or more of your bees.
Was there any evidence that crops in Kentucky or Indiana have suffered as a result of this?
No, I think, again, because we're not really seeing evidence of this in Kentucky. Our mm-hmm. beekeepers, we've just had two of the best nectar years in Kentucky back-to-back in years. Mm-hmm. Now, the first winter when this hit the migratory beekeepers, we had a real severe winter for bees here. So we also, last spring, and this is 2007, we came out of that winter, a lot of beekeepers in Kentucky saw a lot of losses. Mm-hmm. But they seem to be more to do with the conditions the summer before. The fall wasn't a good fall for us, and our hives went into the winter and not in real good shape. It seemed to be more of an explainable local conditions that caused us. And then we bounced back last year. We had a really good nectar flow in the spring, and our bees just recovered and did real well, where elsewhere the migratory beekeepers were losing their hives.
Now, I'll be honest,
I think there were a number of beekeepers in Kentucky who lost hives in the winter 2000-2006. They were hearing all of this in the media about mm-hmm. the commercial people and thinking, well, this must have been what happened to me. But as the time went on, more and more of them told me, you know, I thought mine was related to what was going on elsewhere, but I realize now my bees just starved to death. Mm-hmm. Or my bees were in poor condition, and that's what happened.
So, Phil, bottom line, it sounds like the migratory bees are running away from home.
Well,
I thought,
but actually they're not. I think it's sad. they're flying away and dying.
Okay.
Most bees actually die outside the hive.
Okay.
Foraging is the last job they do, and so a bee that's older, it flies out to make that last foraging flight and doesn't have the strength to fly back. That's how most bees die. We don't find a lot of dead bees normally in our hives.
Mm-hmm. Are there natural bees that don't live in hives that are doing the job too?
Well, we do have some native pollinators, things like bumblebees and things like that, that do some pollination. What we've got to remember is our agriculture has really developed, parts of our agriculture have developed with bees. Things like, again, our apples and our squash and cantaloupes and cucumbers and pumpkins, all those sorts of crops have developed with bees as being the prime pollinator. And while we'll get some pollination from native pollinators, and specifically things like bumblebees, it's typically not enough. Bees are really good at pollinating things. And the big growers are really dependent on beekeepers bringing hives in.
Phil, bottom line then, you all maybe it could be some other, you know, pest issue or disease issue, but looks like it could just be stress?
Yeah, well, that stress is part of it. There's pesticides are an issue. That's one of the things. Again, if you're a migratory beekeeper and you're pollinating these big crops, pesticides is always a concern. Pesticides that are being applied by the grower to, you know, kill pests and stuff in their field. So pesticides are an issue. They're looking at possible pathogens, old pathogens, new pathogens, and pests. Varroa mites are still an issue. Varroa mites seem to be a bigger problem for commercial beekeepers, partly because they're having more of a problem with resistance to the chemicals we've been using to kill mites with.
Mm-hmm. So still a little bit of a mystery. Is it happening anywhere else on other continents or anything?
Well, I'm hearing things about... It's hard for me to keep up with more than what's going on right in my back door.
Mm-hmm.
But I am hearing about losses in Europe in particular, but I'm not so sure that they're totally parallel. This does seem to be more of a problem here, a different sort of problem here.
All right.
And again, I think our migratory beekeepers here are unique.
Yeah. All right, Phil, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Uh-huh. Phil Kraft is state apiarist with the Kentucky Department of Agriculture. For more information on bees, be sure to visit them at the Kentucky State Fair or go to our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Consumer Reports and the trends in lawn mowing equipment. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And I hear a buzz in the distance.
I do hear a buzz
not
in the
just
distance.
Bees.
Not just bees, in fact.
Somebody testing lawnmowers.
Somebody testing lawnmowers.
What a job.
No kidding. And like the lawn thing, the lawn phenomenon is amazing. People used to have sheep on their front lawns, and they, grazed. Or they had a vegetable garden in the front sort of thing, so they didn't have a lawn. Lawn sort of came later when suburbia emerged.
They have a billion acres of...
And it's an industry in and of itself, isn't it?
And the lawnmowers need to be tested, and we've got a guy to do it for us.
And what's so interesting, because haven't you noticed more and more kind of push and advertising for the old-fashioned mowers, the old real mowers?
Yeah,
so
but I also see
something's amiss.
More and more people are hiring their lawns done, so...
Not me.
Not me either, believe me.
All right.
I couldn't afford them. But we've got the guy with some answers to all this conundrum, this lawnmower conundrum. Peter Sawchuk is Senior Project Leader for Recreation and Home Improvement for Consumer Reports Magazine. He's had a long career in industry product development and my favorite all-time title, Chairman of the American National Standard Institute's Chipper Shredder Product Safety Standard Committee. Peter, welcome to Homegrown.
Oh, it's great to be there.
So in terms of the different types of mowers that you all test, it seems that people are pushing more electric mowers, more old-fashioned real mowers, in fact. More companies are coming out with ones that they claim are, really good. You test those. What's the bottom line in terms of the way that gas-powered, electric, and real, stack up with each other?
Well, let me talk about the electric first.
Okay.
They, of course, come in two varieties, one of them being the ones with electric cords and the other ones being battery-powered. Now, the electric corded ones are actually more powerful, but you're limited to the 100-foot electric cord. And quite honestly, I found in the small amount of time that I use them in testing that the cord's pretty much a nuisance. So more power to you if you can bear with the cord that's dragging around and flopping around behind you, but certainly they're a cost-effective way to go. For most people, I think you're really looking at the battery-powered units. And the good news here is there are some units that we found that do a good job. Now, generally, you get about 45, maybe 50 minutes of cutting time, which for, say, a quarter-acre lawn, when you're looking at a lawn that's maybe 7,000 square feet in actual lawn space, you're going to do quite nicely. The other downside is, of course, they're all push. There's no self-propelled, so if you have a number of hills or grades, it may not be appropriate for you. And the other thing is they're a little expensive. We have found a couple at $300 that are quite good, but you could be looking at $400 for a unit.
Peter, what about real mowers?
You brought up real mowers, and yes, there's a real, no pun intended, there's an insurgence and a resurrection of an interest in these push-type reel mowers, often referred to in Europe as the cylinder mowers. And we've tested, actually we tested six of them this last time. And basically, something you should know is nearly all of them are made by one company out in Indiana.
Are they?
Now, those units, to be honest, the bottom line is they're not as good as you want. The quality of cut is not great. Mm-hmm. The other thing we find, there are a couple of European ones that cut really nicely, but the maximum they cut is under 2 inches. That means in the U.S., your lawn is going to be exposed during warm weather to turning brown.
Okay.
So we don't see any really good answer there. You get people say, oh, I just love doing it. I love the exercise. But we don't see it that way.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, a jagged cut, not a good clean cut on your lawn, opens it up for other sort of disease opportunities as well. So,
well, unfortunately, let me correct you there. A cylinder mower is like a pair of scissors.
Mm-hmm.
The good news with it is it gives you a nice, clean cut, and
you get a
cleaner lawn than you do with a rotary mower, which actually just whacks the grass.
Okay.
However,
it's
the grass height that's a real problem.
Yeah.
You really want to be cutting as it gets, to save water and so forth. You want to be at least 2.5 inches high. 3
sure.
is better. Now, a number of the Pushmores, the Scots, and a couple of others will get you up that high, but we found with the wheel marks and everything, boy, I just couldn't get the kind of cut that I wanted from those.
Okay. I'm wondering, in terms of trends, in terms of size and such, you know, it seems like, you know, people love their power equipment. And when I was growing up, everybody just had a push lawnmower in their, you know, subdivision yard. And now people, like, have riding lawnmowers in a yard that I would think, you know, a push mower is plenty for. So are we continuing to get, like, fancier with our lawn equipment? Or are we actually starting to, like, our cars, we're downsizing with our cars a little bit, at least. Is there any trend that we are perhaps downsizing with our lawn equipment as well? Tractors and, you know, like the zero turn and riding mowers and tractors and such?
Well, at the moment, we don't see that because gas prices have only started to hit this year.
Mm-hmm.
And we've tried to address some of this. We've gotten a lot of questions at Consumer Reports about single-cylinder engines versus twins and how much gasoline they use. And a twin-cylinder engine clearly uses more gasoline, not a lot more, but more gasoline. And the fact does remain that ride-on lawn equipment uses a whole lot more gasoline than walk-behind equipment.
Okay. So what would you recommend, say, for just the average person for a good push mower, the best buy for the money?
Okay, for a rotary walk-behind mower. Now, I'm going to tell you this. For push, to be honest with you, most push mowers are about $200.
Right.
And they're all pretty much the same.
So there.
You know,
okay.
The quality cut's going to be adequate. So, you know, price is probably going to be one of the issues. The other ones that I like is the grip on the bale, and some are more comfortable than others.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
One that I like a lot for a couple of reasons, there's a Cub Cadet. And the Cub Cadet's an 18-inch. It's a little bit narrower than most mower, but for a push mower, and it's a little more expensive, it's $220. But that Cub Cadet has a high-quality engine on it. That is, it has an overhead valve engine on, mm-hmm. which is easier to start as the mower gets older, and it will last longer. So I really like that particular mower, recommend it to people. Again, it's a Cub Cadet, 18-inch mm-hmm. Cub Cadet, and you can buy that at Home Depot.
So what about durability? You know, some lawn mowers sort of get put through the ringer depending on how you're using them, and I kind of put my push mower through the ringer because we're using it in hard-to-mow places. You know, so, like, parts break off or whatever. Have you assessed durability with any of them?
We don't have time to do durability on mowers. And generally what you're going to find with mowers is they're good for about, in total, about 150 hours of work, which is about 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
People who stretch mowers longer are going to face problems of breakage and so forth.
Okay, maybe that's my problem.
Right.
And here's another thing. People are concerned about emissions. Clearly, you no longer see two-cycle walk-behind mowers.
Right.
They can't make the emission standards.
Okay.
So if you got one of those,
and
get rid of it.
I do.
Should get rid of it.
All right.
You're a big, bad polluter.
Well, yes, sir, I will.
End of the story.
And especially since half parts of it are broken off, it's time to get a new one, right?
Right. And you'll get a much cleaner cut. They'll
yeah.
start much different. But figure a mower is going to last you roughly 8 years.
Okay.
How about the mulching mowers? Do they work?
Mulching mowers have gotten better and better all the time.
Okay.
And there are a number of them out there that work very well. Now, again, the grass needs to be dry when you mulch. And the other thing that I urge people on mulching is to make sure when you finish each time that you wash out the underside of the deck so you're starting with a nice, clean deck that doesn't have a lot of material build up
yeah.
inside of it.
But come on, how many people really do that?
Well, if you want to get a good mulching job, that's what you got to do.
That's what you got to do. Because there were some other interesting things, too, Peter, about, you know, asking people the questions if they really do what's recommended in terms of properly mowing, in terms of height, in terms of safety issues for themselves. And you guys found out some interesting statistics. Can you tell us about them, please?
Well, of course, I don't have the stats right in front of
right.
me at the moment, but among them were, you know, who thinks their neighbor, how many people think their neighbor has a better lawn? And, of course, most people think their neighbor's lawn is better.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that we thought was interesting is the number of people who indicated that they were drinking while they were consuming alcohol during the time they were mowing, which is definitely a no-no.
Definitely no-no. And I know there was one in terms of wearing hearing protection. or, you know, noise protection. And my tip is to tear a little piece of toilet paper into two pieces and to put them in your ears, and that is pretty sufficient, you know, unless you want to get the fancy headphones.
Well, I can differ with you on that, although that helps.
Yeah.
If you're on that mower for more than 30 minutes, whether you're riding or walking, particularly if you're riding, you will have hearing irreversible hearing damage.
All right.
End of story. And we used to say politely and politically correctly at Consumer Reports, we recommend it's not recommended. You want to go, you want to hurt your hearing, don't wear hearing protection.
All right, Peter, I need earphones and a new push lawnmower, don't I?
Okay, two things. Here's something I recommend for a couple things. The foam earplugs actually work really well.
Okay.
The other one I like, and this is what I use at the test site, they're like the foam ones, but they've got, it's almost like the stethoscope for a doctor.
Okay.
You know, they've got a little U that goes under, and they just pop right in your ears, and they hang down under your chin.
Mm-hmm.
Works great, and I'm converting to that all the time.
Okay. Oh. Good tip.
I hear you, man.
Yep.
A couple of other quick tips if you got time.
Absolutely.
Back to pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, it's nice to have a new mower that doesn't pollute, but this is what's interesting. Raw fuel, when spilled, particularly when it comes to its nitrous oxide, which gives you the overhead smog.
Sure.
That's four times worse when it's raw fuel versus burn fuel.
Hmm.
And we all, myself included, when you go to fill the gas tank,
be very
tend
careful
to overspill.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, that's a bigger contributor than, you know, running the engine.
Right.
So you want to take steps to try to eliminate that. And in some states, it's required now to use a no-spill gas tank. California, that's all you can buy.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend to people that they switch to those because you keep from spilling that gas. And if every time you go out, you spill a quarter cup of gas, half cup of gas, you know, pretty soon you're looking at a gallon and a half of gas during the season that you've just thrown away, and it stinks and it smells and everything else. And one of these no-spill gas cans that, you know, when the gas comes up, it shuts off.
Hmm. Oh, okay, so that's how it works.
And you can buy those at Home Depot, any of the places, all over the country, sell them.
All right.
Well, Peter, thank you very much. You once again filled a niche here on lawnmowers.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I got more work. Got more work to do. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Peter Sawchuk is Senior Project Leader for Consumer Reports Magazine. For more information on Consumer Reports testing of lawnmowers, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here.
And, hey, we're back to roses in a roundabout way.
Yep.
We've got a question from Marsha Busey in Trimble County. She needs help identifying a terrible disease that has infected her big Rugosa rose. Rugosas are fabulous roses, old, big old-fashioned roses.
911.
She says, let's see, half of the rose has distorted fine leafed foliage, yellow in color.
Oh.
It doesn't match the description of the rosette disease in the foliage, and it's not red. She did notice it last year, but the whole plant's not affected. She's, you know, wondering what's going on and what she should do.
It's elementary, my dear Watson. That's the old Halloween disease.
Bob means witch's broom.
Oh, that's what I meant. Yeah.
It sounds like a perfect description of witch's broom to me. And my understanding of witch's broom, Bob, you know, in terms of plant pathologists, is that there's not really anything you can do about it. They believe that it's spread by a small insect, like a mite, basically. But then it gets in the vascular system of the plant. And once it's in the plant, it's there. You know, so it's like a virus.
Yeah.
And then it causes that real kind of stunted, fine, chlorotic, or veined growth. And roses are, you know, it's real common for roses to get them. Not anything you can do about it, really. But what we've done in the past, just to sort of like make plants last a little bit longer without looking too freaky, just cut back as much as you can all the way to the ground, all the diseased stuff, remove it.
Yeah,
and then it might slow the processes of it. But once it shows up in a plant, it usually will persist.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So
cut it back, see what happens next year.
And get a big shovel,
you know, that sort of thing. And you may need to replace it.
Boy.
Sorry.
If you have a question or a problem for which Bob or Janine have no solution, visit the homegrown.
It's not my fault.
Visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at Hopeless 814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
I've been known to joke about the fabulous plant story. This is a...
Is it pretty fabulous?
Yeah, well, semi-fabulous.
Okay.
It's a good one. It's the zinnia.
Zinnia.
Zinnia. See, I'm already off in bad shape.
You mean that woman that's the warrior princess?
No. Oh, yeah.
Zinnia.
Princess Zinnia.
Zinnia.
Anyway.
Yeah.
This year, it's a huge flower this year. I planted them in my alleys to fill in the gap in the colors.
I love them.
Fabulous plant. It's just booming right now. It's just booming. Of course, the powdery mildew hasn't arrived yet. But maybe, may not, but we'll see. Anyway, the zinnia was originally found in Mexico, and like the cosmos, was sent from Mexico to Spain by a professor, Casimir Gomez de Ortega, to a friend in Madrid about 300 years ago. Everybody hated it. The flowers were small and ugly, and nobody cared.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Spaniards called him mal de ojos. You probably know
bad
this.
Bad eye.
Bad eye, exactly. Uh-huh. That's what they called him, evil eye. Then about 1750, Linnaeus, God bless Linnaeus.
And the Swedes.
Yeah. He named the flower for a guy named Johann Gottfried Zinn.
Hmm.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either.
A medical professor at Göttingen University who wrote a book about the flora around the university. And also was the first to describe the iris in the eye in detail. That's kind of cool. He discovered that the eyeball of the man is larger than the eyeball of the woman, regardless of the height.
Hmm.
Little side effect there for you.
Yeah.
Zinn also died of a most consumptive disease at age 32.
Uh-oh.
So, yeah, it's a good thing he got famous before he died.
Before he died, yeah.
And this small, ugly zinnia was not popular until David Burpee.
Oh, the Burpee Seed Company.
You got it. About 100 years ago, planted out 100 rows as a test and found in row 66.
A mutated humongo one.
The modern zinnia.
Awesome.
They called it Old 66.
Really?
Yep.
That's great.
And then that became the zinnia augustifolia.
Yeah,
it's a good story.
No.
The zinnia augustifolia, they kind of bred it from there, and they got the profusion now, which is a lot better zinnia.
Yeah.
Zinnia profusion.
But the garden zinnias I love, the big ones that are good for cut flowers.
That's what I've got. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's great. You deadhead them when they're older, and they'll bloom for a long time. They now have all kinds. There's single zinnias, double zinnias, semi-double zinnias. There's also triple and home run zinnias.
Yeah, and there's a bajillion different colors, even a green one called NB.
Well, you know a lot about these.
Well, not just because I grow them.
I like them a lot,
I didn't know the story.
Sun-loving, take a lot of drought, must-have drainage, insect-resistant, powdery mildew is a problem.
Susceptible, yeah.
If you give it full air circulation and good sun... You can avoid that.
Yeah.
And
a great cut flower.
It does. And it comes with a poem. Let us now commence and begin a pithy poem to a man named Zinn, a medical doc who died of a virus, but not until he gazed in the iris. And who would ever want to die remembered only as Evil Eye? That was the flower that bore his name into the Horticultural Hall of Shame. When rescued there by David Burpee, who planted zinnias until he could see, one beauty on whom the public would fix, that sainted, that visionary, Old 66.
That is great. I love that story.
I rest my case.
See, I'm thinking, Andy and I think that maybe we have a really special echinacea.
Ah.
It came up, it's the first year it bloomed. It came up underneath the tree that was planted a couple years ago.
Yeah.
But the plant was always there, you know. I mean, like the just the foliage. First year that it bloomed. So we're going to watch it because we think it's our million.
Yep.
So always pay attention to the moral of the story. Pay attention to those morphed plants out in your yard, right? It could turn into the zinnia.
You too could be Gottfried Zinn.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, Bob. Thanks a lot.
Yes, ma'am.
I like knowing the rest of the story about one of my favorite annuals. All right. That ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, the Owensboro Arboretum has more than just plants.
Homegrown is produced by the zesty Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.